bites. Then she and whoever else was home at the time would have to listen to him compare her with all the other women he knew. They fought physically, too. When that happened, my brother would try to break it up, or I'd have to call the police. It was really awful. After he was gone, back on the road again, my mother would usually have these long talks with my brother and me, asking us if she should leave Dad. Neither of us wanted to be responsible for that decision, even though we hated their fighting, so we'd try to avoid answering. But she never did go, because she was too afraid of losing the financial support he provided. She started seeing the doctor a lot and began taking pills instead, in order to stand it. Then she didn't care what Dad did. She'd just go off to her room, take an extra pill or two, and stay inside with the door shut. After she was inside her room, I had to take over a lot of her responsibilities, but in some ways I didn't mind. It was better than listening to the fighting. By the time I met my future husband, I was really good at taking over for other people. Robbie already had a drinking problem when we met in our junior year of high school. He even had a nickname, Bergie, because he drank so much Burgermeister beer. But that didn't bother me. I was sure I could take care of whatever bad habits Robbie had. I'd always been told that I was mature for my age, and I believed it. There was something so sweet about Robbie that I was immediately drawn to him. He reminded me of a cocker spaniel, all soft and appealing with great big brown eyes. We began dating when I let it be known to his best friend that I was interested. I practically arranged the whole thing myself. I felt I had to make it happen because he was so shy. We went together steadily from then on. Occasionally, he wouldn't show up for a date, and the next day he'd be very sorry, very apologetic that he'd gotten carried away with drinking and had forgotten. I'd lecture and scold and finally forgive him. He almost seemed grateful that he had me to keep him on the straight and narrow. I was always as much a mother to him as a girlfriend. I used to hem his pants and remind him about his family members' birthdays and advise him about what to do in school and with his career. Robbie had nice parents, but there were six kids. His grandfather, who was ill, lived with them too. Everybody was a little distracted with the pressure of it all, and I was more than willing to make up for the attention Robbie wasn't getting at home. The draft caught up with him after he'd been out of high school a couple of years. It was during the early build-up in Vietnam, and if a young man was married, he was exempt from service. I couldn't bear the thought of what would happen to Robbie in Vietnam. I could say I was afraid he would be injured or killed, but if I'm honest, I have to admit I was even more afraid that he would grow up over there and not need me anymore when he came back. I made it very clear that I was willing to marry him to keep him out of the service, and so that's what we did. We got married when we were both 20. I remember he got so drunk at the wedding reception that I had to drive so we could leave on our honeymoon. It made a great joke. After our sons were born, Robbie's drinking got worse. He would tell me he needed to get away from all the pressure and that we had married too young. He went on a lot of fishing trips and had lots of nights out with the boys. I never really got angry because I felt so sorry for him. Each time he drank, I made excuses for him and tried harder to make it nicer at home. I suppose we could have gone on forever that way, with things getting a little worse each year, except that his drinking was finally noticed at work. His co-workers and boss confronted him and gave him the choice of getting sober or losing his job. Well, he got sober. That's when the trouble started. All those years that Robbie had been drinking and messing up, I knew two things. One, he needed me, and two, no one else would put up with them. And that was the only way I could feel safe. Yes, I had to put up with a lot, but that was okay. I'd come from a home where my father did much worse things than Robbie ever did. My dad beat my mother and had lots of affairs with women he met in bars, so having a husband who just drank too much was really not that hard on me. Besides, I could run the house the way I wanted to, and when he really blew it, I'd scold and cry, and he'd straighten out for a week or two. I didn't really want any more than that. Of course, I didn't know any of this until he got sober. All of a sudden, my poor, helpless Robbie was going to AA meetings every night, making friends, having serious talks on the phone with people I didn't even know, Then he got himself a sponsor in AA. And this man was the one to whom he turned every time he had a problem or a question. I felt like I'd been fired from my job, and I was furious. Again, if I'm going to be honest, I have to admit I liked the whole situation better when he was drinking. Before sobriety, I used to call his boss with phony excuses when Robbie was too hungover to go to work. I lied to his family and friends about the trouble he got into at work or driving drunk. In general, I ran interference between him and life. Now, I couldn't even get in the game. Whenever something difficult had to be handled, he'd get on the phone with his sponsor, who always insisted that Robbie meet problems head-on. Then he'd face it, whatever it was, and afterwards he'd call his sponsor again to give him a report. Through it all, I was left on the sidelines. Although I'd lived for years with an irresponsible, unreliable, and very dishonest man, it was when Robbie had been sober for 9 months and was improving in every area that we found we were fighting more than we ever had. What made me angriest was that he would call his AA sponsor to find out how to handle me. It seemed I was the biggest threat to his sobriety. I was preparing to file for divorce when his sponsor's wife called me and asked if we could meet for coffee. I very reluctantly agreed, and she just laid it out. She talked about how hard it had been for her when her husband got sober, because she could no longer manage him and every aspect of their life together. She talked about how much she had resented his AA meetings and especially his sponsor, and that she considered it a miracle that they were still married, not to mention that they were actually happy. She said that Al-Anon had helped her enormously and urged me to attend a few meetings. Well, I only half listened. I still believed that I was fine and also that Robbie owed me a lot for putting up with him all those years. I felt he should be trying to make that up to me, rather than going to meetings all the time. I had no idea how hard it was for him to stay sober, and he wouldn't have dared to tell me because I would have told him how to do it, as though I knew anything about it. About this time, one of our sons started stealing and having other problems at school. Robbie and I went to a parent conference, and somehow it came out that Robbie was a sober alcoholic attending AA. The counselor strongly suggested that our son go to Alateen and asked if I was an Al-Anon. I felt cornered, but this woman had a lot of experience with families like ours, and she was very gentle with me. All our sons started going to Alateen, but I still stayed away from Al-Anon. I went ahead with divorce proceedings and moved myself and the kids to an apartment. When it was time to settle all the details, the boys quietly told me that they wanted to live with their dad. I was devastated. After I left Robbie, I had focused all my attention on them, and here they were choosing him over me. I had to let them go. They were old enough to decide for themselves. That left me alone with just me. And I had never been alone with just me before. I was terrified and depressed and hysterical all at once. After a few days of being totally out of commission, I called Robbie's sponsor's wife. I wanted to blame her husband and AA for all my pain. She listened to me scream at her for a long time. Then she came over and sat with me while I cried and cried and cried. She took me to an Al-Anon meeting the next day. And I listened, even though I was terrifically angry and afraid. I began very slowly to see how sick I was. I went to meetings every day for 3 months. After that, I went 3 or 4 times a week for a long time. You know, in those meetings, I actually learned to laugh at the things I had taken so seriously, like trying to change others, and managing and controlling other people's lives. And I would listen to other people talk about how hard it was for them to take care of themselves instead of focusing all their attention on the alcoholic. That was true for me, too. I had no idea what I needed to make me happy. I'd always believed I'd be happy as soon as everybody else shaped up. I saw people there who were just so beautiful, and some of them were with partners who were still drinking. They'd learned to let go and get on with their own lives. But I also heard from all of them how hard it was to let go of our old ways of taking care of everything and everybody and acting like a parent to the alcoholic. Hearing some of these people talk about how they got through the problem of being alone and the feelings of emptiness helped me find my way, too. I learned to stop feeling sorry for myself and to be grateful for what I did have in my life. Pretty soon, I wasn't crying for hours anymore and found I had a lot of time on my hands, so I went to work part-time. That helped, too. I began to feel good about doing something all by myself. It wasn't long before Robbie and I were talking about getting back together. I was dying to jump right back in, but his sponsor advised him to wait a while. His sponsor's wife said the same thing to me. I didn't understand it then, but other people in the program all agreed with them, so we held off. I see now why that was necessary. It was important for me to wait until there was somebody home inside me before I went back with Robbie. At first I was so empty I felt like the wind was blowing through me. But with each decision I made for myself, that empty place filled in a little. I had to find out who I was, what I liked and disliked, what I wanted for myself and my life. I couldn't learn those things unless I had time alone, without anybody else to think about and worry over, because when someone else was around, I much preferred running that person's life over living my own. When we began to think about getting back together, I watched myself start phoning Robbie about every little thing, wanting to meet him and talk over every detail. I could feel myself going backward each time I called him, so finally, when I needed someone to talk to, I'd go to a meeting or call someone in the program. It was like weaning myself, but I knew that I had to learn to let things flow between us rather than jumping in all the time and trying to force things to go the way I wanted. This pulling back was incredibly difficult for me. I think it may have been much harder for me to leave Robbie alone than it was for him to leave alcohol alone. But I knew I had to. Otherwise, I would have slipped into all the old roles again. It's funny, I finally realized that not until I liked living alone was I ready to go back into the marriage. Almost a year went by, and somewhere in there the kids and Robbie and I all got back together. He had never wanted a divorce, though now I can't understand why not. I was so controlling of all of them. Anyway, I got better and let go of all of them more, and we're really okay now. The boys are in Alateen, Robbie's in AA, and I'm in Al-Anon. I think we're each healthier than we've ever been, because we're each living our own life. There is very little to add to Janice's story. Her tremendous need to be needed, to have a weak, inadequate man, and to control that man's life were all ways to deny and avoid the inevitable emptiness at her core, arising from her early years with her family. It has already been noted that children in dysfunctional families feel responsible for their family's problems and also for solving them. There are basically three ways in which these children attempt to save their families, by being invisible, by being bad, or by being good. To be invisible means to never ask for anything, never cause trouble, never make any kind of demand. The child who chooses this role scrupulously avoids adding any burden to her already stressed family. She stays in her room or blends into the wallpaper. She says very little and makes what she does say noncommittal. In school, she is neither bad nor good. In fact, she is rarely remembered at all. Her contribution to the family is to not exist. As for her own pain, she is numb. She feels nothing. To be bad is to be the rebel, the juvenile delinquent, the one who waves a red flag. This child sacrifices herself, agreeing to be the family's scapegoat, the family's problem. She makes herself the focus for the family's pain, anger, fear, and frustration. Her parents' relationship may be disintegrating, but she provides them with a safe topic they can work on together. They can ask, "What are we going to do about Joni?" instead of, "What are we going to do about our marriage?" This is how she tries to save the family, and she has only one feeling, anger. It covers her pain and her fear. To be good is to be what Janice was, an achiever out in the world, whose accomplishments are aimed at redeeming the family and filling the emptiness inside. Appearing happy, bright, and enthusiastic serves to cover the tension, fear, and anger inside. Looking good becomes much more important than feeling good, than feeling anything. Janice eventually needed to add taking care of someone to her list of accomplishments, and Robbie, replicating her father's alcoholism and her mother's passive dependency, was a likely choice. He, and after he left the children, became her career, her project, and her way of avoiding her own feelings. Without her husband or her sons on whom to focus her attention, a breakdown was inevitable, because they had been the primary means by which she could avoid her pain, emptiness, and fear. Without them, her feelings overwhelmed her. Janice had always seen herself as the strong one, the person who helped, encouraged, and advised those around her. Yet her husband and sons actually served a more important role for her than she did for them. Even though they lacked her strength and maturity, they could function without her. She could not function without them. That this family ultimately survived intact is due largely to their good fortune at seeing an experienced counselor and to the honesty and wisdom of Robbie's sponsor and his wife. Each of these people recognized that Janice's disease was as debilitating as Robbie's, and her recovery every bit as important. Ruth, 28, married, mother of two daughters. I knew, even before we married, that Sam had problems with sexual performance. We'd attempted to make love together a couple of times, and it never really worked. But both of us blamed it on the fact that we weren't married. We shared very strong religious convictions. In fact, we met in night classes at a religious college and went together for 2 years before we ever tried to have sexual relations. By then, we were engaged, with the wedding date set, so we shrugged off Sam's impotence as God's way of protecting us from sinning before we were married. I thought that Sam was just a very shy young man, and that I'd be able to help him get over that once we were married. I looked forward to sort of leading him through it all, except that's not the way it worked out. On our wedding night, Sam was all ready to go, and then he lost his erection and asked me quietly, "Are you still a virgin?" When I didn't answer right away, he said, "I didn't think so." And he got up, went in the bathroom, and closed the door. We were each crying on our opposite sides of that door. It was a long, disastrous night, the first of many more just like it. I had been engaged before I met Sam to a man I didn't even like very much, but he'd swept me off my feet once, and we'd had sex together. And after that, I felt I had to marry him to redeem myself. He eventually got tired of me and just drifted away. I was still wearing his ring when I met Sam. I guess I expected to be celibate forever after that experience, but Sam was so kind and never pressured me to be sexual with him, so I felt safe and accepted. I could see that Sam was even less sophisticated and more conservative than I was in the area of sex, and that made me feel in control of the situation. That fact, along with our shared religious convictions, assured me we were perfect for each other. After our marriage, because of my guilt, I took on all the responsibility for curing Sam's impotence. I read every book I could find, while he refused to read any. I kept all those books, hoping he would read them. I found out later that he did read them all, when I wasn't looking. He was frantic for answers, too, but I didn't know that because Sam didn't want to talk about it. He'd ask me if I was willing to just be friends, and I'd lie and say yes. The worst part for me was not the lack of sex in our lives. I didn't care much about that anyway. It was my guilt, my feeling that I had ruined everything somehow, right at the beginning. Something I hadn't tried yet was therapy. I asked him if he'd go. He said absolutely not. I'd become obsessed by them, with the feeling that I was depriving him of this wonderful sex life he could have had, except for the fact that he'd married me. I still felt that maybe there was something a therapist could tell me that would help, something the books had left out. By this time, I was desperate to help Sam, and I still loved him. I realize now that a great deal of my love for him at that time was really a combination of guilt and pity, but there was genuine caring for him, too. He was a good, sweet, kind man. Anyway, I went to my first appointment, which was with a counselor who had been recommended by Planned Parenthood as having expertise in human sexuality. I was only there to help Sam, and I told her that. She said that we couldn't help Sam because Sam wasn't there in the office, but we could work with me. And how did I feel about what was and wasn't happening between Sam and me? I wasn't at all prepared to talk about my feelings. I didn't even know I had any. We spent that whole first hour with me trying to shift the topic back to Sam, and she leading me gently back to myself and my feelings. It was the first time I'd ever seen how skilled I was at avoiding myself, and mostly because she was so honest with me, I decided to see her again, even though we weren't working on what I was sure was the real problem, Sam. Between our second and third sessions, I had a very vivid and disturbing dream in which I was chased and threatened by a figure whose face I couldn't see. When I told my therapist about it, she helped me work with the dream until I realized that the threatening figure was my father. This was the first step in a long process that finally led to my being able to remember that my father had sexually molested me frequently between the years when I was 9 and 15. I had completely buried this entire aspect of my life, and when the memories began to return, I could let them surface into my awareness only a little bit at a time because they were so devastating. My father would often go out in the evening and not come home until late. My mother, I guess to punish him, would lock him out of their bedroom on those nights. He was supposed to sleep on the couch, but after a while he started coming into my bed. He both cajoled and threatened me never to tell, and I never did, because my shame was so great. I was sure that what was happening between us was my fault. Ours was a family where sexual issues were never discussed, but somehow the general attitude that sex was dirty was still communicated. I certainly felt dirty, and I didn't want anyone to know. I got a job when I was 15, working nights, weekends, and summers. I stayed away from home as much as I could, and I bought a lock for my door. The first time I locked my father out, he stood there, pounding on my door. I pretended not to know what was happening, and my mother woke up and asked him what he was doing. He actually said, "Ruth's got her door locked." And my mother said, "So? Go to sleep." That was the end of it. No questions from my mother. No more visits from my father. It had taken every ounce of courage I had to put a lock on my door. I was afraid it wouldn't work, and that my father would get in and be angry that I'd tried to lock him out. But even more so, I was almost willing to go on the same way rather than run the risk of anyone finding out what had been going on. I left home for college at 17 and met the man to whom I became engaged at 18. I was sharing an apartment with two other girls, and one night they had some friends over whom I didn't know. I went to bed early, mostly to avoid the pot-smoking scene that was developing, though practically all the students flouted the school's very strict rules about drinking and drugs. I never did get used to being around it, or doing it. Anyway, my bedroom door was right next to the bathroom door, and both were at the end of a long hallway. One of the guys at the party who was looking for the bathroom came into my room by mistake. When he saw what he had done, instead of leaving, he asked if he could talk to me. I couldn't say no. It's hard to explain that, but I just couldn't. Well, he sat on the side of my bed and talked to me. Then he told me to turn over and he would give me a back rub. Pretty soon, he was in my bed, making love to me. And that was how I ended up engaged to him. Whether he smoked pot or not, I think he was nearly as conservative as I was, and believed as I did that having sex together meant we had to stay together. We saw each other for about 4 months until, as I say, he just drifted away. I met Sam a little over a year later. Then I assumed, because he and I never talked about sex, that we were avoiding it because of our religious convictions. I didn't realize we were avoiding it because we were both so sexually damaged. I liked the feeling of helping Sam, of working hard with him to overcome our problem for the sake of my becoming pregnant. I liked feeling helpful, understanding, patient, and in control. Anything less than that total control would have stirred up all those old feelings of my father approaching me and fondling me through all those nights and all those years. When what had happened between my father and myself began to surface in therapy, my therapist strongly urged me to attend meetings of Daughters United, a self-help group of daughters whose fathers have sexually abused them. I resisted for a long time, but finally got involved. It was really a blessing that I did. To learn that there were so many other women who had experiences similar to, and often much worse than mine, was reassuring and healing. Several of these women had also married men who had sexual problems of their own. These men formed a self-help group, too, and somehow Sam got the courage to join them. Sam's parents had been obsessed with raising him to be, in their words, a pure, clean boy. If he had his hands in his lap at the dinner table, he was ordered to keep them on the table, where we can see what you're doing. If he was in the bathroom too long, they would pound on the door and shout, "What are you doing in there?" It was constant. They searched his drawers for magazines and his clothing for stains. He became so afraid of having any sexual feeling or experience that ultimately he couldn't, even if he tried. As we began to get better, in some ways, life became more difficult for us as a couple. I still had a tremendous need to control Sam's every expression of sexuality, just as his parents had done, because any sexual aggressiveness on his part was so threatening to me. If he reached for me spontaneously, I would flinch, or I would turn over or walk away or start talking or do something else to avoid his advances. I couldn't bear having him lean over me when I was in bed, because it reminded me so much of the way my father had approached me. But his recovery required that he become fully in charge of his body and his feelings. I had to stop controlling him so that he could, literally, experience his own potency. And yet, my fear of being overwhelmed was a big problem, too. I learned to say, "I'm getting scared now." And Sam would answer, "What do you need me to do?" Usually that was enough, just to know that he cared about my feelings and would listen to me. We worked out this deal where we would take turns being in charge of what happened between us sexually. Either of us could say no to anything we didn't like or didn't want to do. But basically, one of us would orchestrate the whole encounter. That was one of the best ideas we ever had, because it addressed the need each of us had to be in charge of our own bodies and what we did with them sexually. We really learned to trust each other and to believe that we could give and receive love with our bodies. We also had our groups for support. Everyone's problems and feelings were so similar that it really helped to keep our struggles in perspective. One night, our two groups met together, and we spent the evening discussing our personal reactions to the words impotent and frigid. There were tears and laughter and so much understanding and sharing. It took a lot of the shame and the pain away for all of us. Maybe because Sam and I had already shared so much by that time, and there was so much trust, the sexual part of our relationship began to work. We have two beautiful daughters now, and we're so happy with them, with ourselves, and with each other. I'm much less of a mother to Sam, and much more of a partner. He's less passive and more assertive. He doesn't need me to keep the secret of his impotence from the world, and I don't need him to be asexual. We have lots of choices now, and we freely choose each other. Ruth's story illustrates another facet of how denial and the need for control manifest themselves. Like so many women who become obsessed with their partner's problems, Ruth knew before her marriage to Sam exactly what his problems were. She was therefore not surprised at their inability to perform sexually together. In fact, that failure was something of a guarantee that she wouldn't ever have to feel out of control of her own sexuality again. She could be the initiator, the one in control, rather than what was for her the only other role in sex, the victim. Again, this couple was fortunate in that the help they received was tailor-made for their problems. For her, the appropriate support group was Daughters United, an offshoot of Parents United, formed to help promote recovery in families where incest has occurred. Luckily, a corresponding group had been formed by the husbands of these incest victims, and in this climate of understanding, acceptance, and shared experience, each of these damaged people could move cautiously toward healthy sexual expression. For each of the women in this chapter, recovery demanded that she face the pain, past and present, that she had attempted to avoid. As a child, each had developed a style for surviving that included practicing denial and attempting to gain control. Later, in adulthood, those styles ill-served these women. In fact, their defenses had become major contributors to their pain. For the woman who loves too much, the practice of denial, magnanimously rephrased as overlooking his faults or keeping a positive attitude, conveniently sidesteps the two-to-tango aspect of how his shortcomings allow her to practice her familiar roles. When her drive to control masquerades as being helpful and giving encouragement, what is ignored again is her own need for the superiority and power implied in this kind of interaction. We need to recognize that the practice of denial and control, called by whatever names, does not ultimately enhance our lives or our relationships. Rather, the mechanism of denial leads us into relationships that allow for the compulsive reenactment of our old struggles. And the need to control keeps us there, striving to change someone else rather than ourselves. Now to return to the fairy tale highlighted at the beginning of the chapter. As noted before, the tale Beauty and the Beast would appear to be a vehicle for perpetuating the belief that a woman has the power to transform a man if she will only love him devotedly. At this level of interpretation, the tale seems to advocate both denial and control as methods for achieving happiness. Beauty, by loving the fearful monster unquestioningly, denial, appears to have the power to change, control him. This interpretation seems accurate because it fits in with the sexual roles our culture dictates. Nonetheless, I suggest that such a simplistic interpretation widely misses the significance of this time-honored fairy tale. That this story endures is not because it reinforces any era's cultural precepts and stereotypes. It endures because it embodies a profound metaphysical law, a vital lesson in how to live our lives wisely and well. It is as if the story contains a secret map, which, if we are but clever enough to decipher it and courageous enough to follow it, will lead us to a rich cache of treasure, our own happily ever after. So what, then, is the point of Beauty and the Beast? It is acceptance. Acceptance is the antithesis of denial and control. It is a willingness to recognize what reality is and to allow that reality to be without a need to change it. Therein lies a happiness that issues not from manipulating outside conditions or people, but from developing inner peace, even in the face of challenges and difficulties. Remember, in the fairy tale, Beauty had no need for the Beast to change. She appraised him realistically, accepted him for what he was, and appreciated him for his good qualities. She did not try to make a prince out of a monster. She did not say, "I'll be happy when he's not an animal anymore." She did not pity him for being what he was or try to change him. And therein lies the lesson. Because of her attitude of acceptance, he was freed to become his own best self. That his true self just happened to be a handsome prince and perfect partner for her demonstrates symbolically that she was rewarded greatly when she practiced acceptance. Her reward was a rich and fulfilling life, signified by living happily ever after with the prince. True acceptance of an individual as he is, without trying to change him through encouragement or manipulation or coercion, is a very high form of love, and very difficult for most of us to practice. At the bottom of all our efforts to change someone else is a basically selfish motive, a belief that through his changing, we will become happy. There is nothing wrong with wanting to be happy, but to place the source of that happiness outside ourselves in someone else's hands means we avoid our ability and responsibility to change our own life for the better. Ironically, it is this very practice of acceptance that allows another to change if he chooses to do so. Let's look at how this works. If a woman's partner has a problem with workaholism, for instance, and she pleads and argues with him about the long hours he spends away from home, what is the usual result? He spends just as much or more time away from her, feeling justified that he has a right to do so in order to escape her endless laments. In other words, by scolding and pleading and trying to change him, she actually enables him to believe that the problem between them is not his workaholism, but her nagging. And indeed, her compulsion to change him may become as large a contributing factor to the emotional distance between them as his compulsion to work. In her efforts to force him to be closer to her, she is actually pushing him further away. Workaholism is a serious disorder, as are all compulsive behaviors. It serves a purpose in her husband's life, probably protecting him from experiencing the closeness and intimacy he fears, and forestalling the upwelling of various uncomfortable emotions, primarily anxiety and despair. Workaholism is one of the means of avoiding oneself that men from dysfunctional families frequently employ, just as loving too much is one of the primary means of avoidance employed by women from these kinds of families. The price he pays for this avoidance is a one-dimensional existence that precludes his enjoying much of what life has to offer. But only he can decide if the price is too high, and only he can choose to take whatever measures and risks are required for him to change. His wife's task is not to straighten out his life, but to enhance her own. Most of us have the ability to be far happier and more fulfilled as individuals than we realize. Often, we don't claim that happiness because we believe someone else's behavior is preventing us from doing so. We ignore our obligation to develop ourselves while we scheme and maneuver and manipulate to change someone else, and we become angry and discouraged and depressed when our efforts fail. Trying to change someone else is frustrating and depressing, but exercising the power we have to affect change in our own life is exhilarating. For the wife of a workaholic to be free to live a fulfilling life of her own, no matter what her husband does, she must come to believe that his problem is not her problem, and that it is not within her power, her duty, or her right to change him. She must learn to respect his right to be who he is, even though she wishes he were different. When she does so, she is free. Free of resentment for his unavailability. Free of guilt for not being able to change him. Free of the burden of trying and trying to change that which she cannot. With less resentment and guilt, she may begin to feel greater affection toward him for the qualities in him that she does appreciate. When she lets go of trying to change him and redirects her energy to developing her own interests, she will experience some measure of happiness and satisfaction, no matter what he does. She may eventually discover that her pursuits are fulfilling enough so that she can enjoy a rich and rewarding life on her own, without much companionship from her husband. Or, as she becomes less and less dependent on him for her happiness, she may decide that her commitment to an absent partner is pointless and may choose to get on with her life free of the constraint of an unrewarding marriage. Neither of these paths is possible as long as she needs him to change in order for her to be happy. Until she accepts him as he is, she is frozen in suspended animation, waiting for him to change before she can begin to live her life. When a woman who loves too much gives up her crusade to change the man in her life, he is then left to ponder the consequences of his own behavior. Since she is no longer frustrated and unhappy, but rather is becoming more and more excited about life, the contrast to his own existence intensifies. He may choose to struggle with disengaging from his obsession and becoming more physically and emotionally available. Or he may not. But no matter what he chooses to do, by accepting the man in her life exactly as he is, a woman becomes free, one way or another, to live her own life, happily ever after. Chapter 8. When one addiction feeds another. At our worst, we women who love too much are relationship addicts, man junkies strung out on pain, fear, and yearning. As if this weren't bad enough, men may not be the only thing we're hooked on. In order to block our deepest feelings from childhood, some of us have also developed dependencies on addictive substances. In our youth or later in adulthood, we may have begun abusing alcohol or other drugs, or, most typically, for women who love too much, food. We have overeaten or undereaten, or both, in order to tune out reality, distract ourselves, and numb the vast emotional emptiness deep inside us. Not every woman who loves too much also eats too much or drinks too much or uses too many drugs. But for those of us who do, our recovery from relationship addiction must go hand in hand with our recovery from addiction to whatever substance we abuse. Here's why. The more we depend on alcohol, drugs, or food, the more guilt, shame, fear, and self-hate we feel. Increasingly lonely and isolated, we may become desperate for the reassurance a relationship with a man seems to promise. Because we feel terrible about ourselves, we want a man to make us feel better. Because we can't love ourselves, we need him to convince us that we are lovable. We even tell ourselves that with the right man, we won't need so much food or alcohol or so many drugs. We use relationships in the same way that we use our addictive substance, to take our pain away. When a relationship fails us, we turn even more frantically to the substance we've abused, again, looking for relief. A vicious cycle is created when physical dependence on a substance is exacerbated by the stress of an unhealthy relationship, and emotional dependence on a relationship is intensified by the chaotic feelings engendered by physical addiction. We use being without a man or being with the wrong man to explain and excuse our physical addiction. Conversely, our continued use of the addictive substance allows us to tolerate our unhealthy relationship by numbing our pain and robbing us of the motivation necessary for change. We blame one for the other. We use one to deal with the other, and we become more and more hooked on both. As long as we are bent on escaping ourselves and avoiding our pain, we stay sick. The harder we try, and the more avenues of escape we pursue, the sicker we get as we compound addictions with obsessions. We eventually discover that our solutions have become our most serious problems. Badly needing relief and finding none, sometimes we can begin to get a little crazy. "I'm here because my attorney sent me." Brenda was nearly whispering as she made this confession on the occasion of our first appointment. I took some things and got caught, and he thought it would be a good idea for me to see someone for counseling," she continued conspiratorially. "That it would look better when I go back to court if they think I'm getting help with my problems." I barely had time to nod before she rushed on. "Except, well, I don't think I really have any problems. I took a couple of things from this little drugstore and forgot to pay for them. That's pretty awful having them think I stole from them, but really it was just an oversight. The worst thing about all this is the embarrassment, but I don't have any real problems, not like some people do." Brenda was presenting one of the most difficult challenges in counseling, a client who was not motivated enough to seek help for herself, indeed, who denies needing any help, yet is there in the office, referred by someone else who thinks counseling would be beneficial. While she chatted on breathlessly, I found myself tuning out the words rushing at me. Instead, I studied the woman herself. She was tall, at least 5'10", and fashion model thin, weighing at the most 115 pounds. She wore an elegantly simple silk dress of deep coral, accented with heavy ivory and gold jewelry. With her honey blonde hair and sea green eyes, she should have been beautiful. The ingredients were all there, but something was off. Something was missing. Her brows were chronically knitted, creating a deep vertical crease between them. She held her breath a lot, nostrils constantly flared, and her hair, though carefully cut and coiffed, was dry and brittle. Her skin was papery and sallow, in spite of an attractive tan. Her mouth would have been wide and full, but she constantly pursed her lips together, making them appear thin and tight. When she smiled, it was as though she was carefully drawing a curtain back across her teeth, and when she spoke, she did so with much lip biting. I began to suspect that she practiced self-induced vomiting, along with binge eating, bulimia, and or self-starvation, anorexia, because of the quality of her skin and hair, as well as her extreme thinness. Women with eating disorders also very frequently have episodes of compulsive stealing, so that was another clue. I also strongly suspected that she was a codependent. In my practice, nearly every woman I have seen with an eating disorder has been the daughter of either one alcoholic, two alcoholics, especially those women who practice bulimia, or an alcoholic and a compulsive eater. Compulsive eaters and alcoholics very frequently marry each other, which is not surprising since so many compulsive eaters are daughters of alcoholics, and daughters of alcoholics tend to marry alcoholics. The compulsive eater is determined to control her food, her body, and her partner through the force of her will. Brenda and I certainly had some work ahead of us. "Tell me about yourself," I requested as gently as I could, even though I knew what was coming. Sure enough, most of what she proceeded to tell me that first day were lies. She was fine. She was happy. She didn't know what happened in the store. She couldn't remember it at all. She'd never taken anything else before. She went on to say that her attorney was very nice, just as I obviously was, and that she didn't want anyone else to know about this incident because no one else would understand, the way the attorney and I did. The flattery was calculated to get me to collude with her that nothing was really wrong, to support her in her myth that the arrest was a mistake, an inconvenient little quirk of fate, and nothing more. Fortunately, there was quite a bit of time between the first appointment and when her case was finally adjudicated. And since she knew I was in contact with her attorney, she kept trying to be a good client. She kept every appointment, and after a while she slowly began to be more truthful, almost in spite of herself. Thankfully, when that happened, she experienced the relief that came from letting go of living a lie. Soon, she was in therapy at least as much for herself as for the effect it might have on a judge hearing the case. By the time she was sentenced, 6 months suspended and full restitution, plus 40 hours of community work that she served at the local girls' club, she was working as hard to become truthful as she had previously worked to cover up who she was and what she did. Brenda's real story, which she at first very hesitantly and cautiously disclosed, began to emerge during our third session. She looked very tired and drawn, and when I commented on this, she admitted having had trouble sleeping that week. "What had happened to cause that?" I queried her. First, she blamed it on the upcoming trial, but that explanation didn't ring entirely true. So I probed, "Is there anything else that's troubling you this week?" She waited a while, determinedly chewing her lips, working her way systematically from top lip to bottom and back. Then she fairly blurted out, "I asked my husband to leave, finally, and now I wish I hadn't. I can't sleep, I can't work, I'm a nervous wreck. I hated what he was doing, running around so obviously with that girl from work, but getting along without him is harder than putting up with all of that. Now I don't know which way to turn, and I wonder if it wasn't all my fault anyway. He always said it was, that I was too cold and distant, not enough of a woman for him. And I guess he was right. I was angry and withdrawn a lot, but it was because he criticized me so much. I kept telling him, if you want me to be warm toward you, then you have to treat me as though you like me and say nice things to me, instead of telling me how awful or dumb or unattractive I am." Then she immediately became frightened, those eyebrows climbing even higher up her forehead, and she began discounting everything she had just disclosed. Waving manicured hands, she disclaimed, "We're not really separated, just taking time off from each other for a while. And Rudy isn't that critical, really. I guess I deserve it. Sometimes I'm tired when I come home from work, and I don't want to cook, especially because he doesn't like what I cook. He likes his mother's cooking so much better that he'll leave the table for his mother's house and then not get home again until 2 in the morning. I just don't feel like trying so hard to make him happy when it never works anyway. But it's not that bad. Lots of women have it worse." "What does he do until 2? He can't be at his mother's all that time," I questioned. "I don't even want to know. I guess he's out with his girlfriend, but I don't care. I like it better when he leaves me alone. Lots of times he wants to fight when he finally does get home, and it was more because of that, making me so tired for work the next day, than his carrying on that finally made me ask him to leave." Here was a woman determined not to feel or reveal her emotions. That they were fairly screaming to make themselves heard only stirred her to create more predicaments in her life in order to drown them out. After our third session, I called her attorney and told him to carefully reiterate to Brenda how important it was that she continue in counseling with me. I was going to take a chance with her, and I didn't want to lose her. At the beginning of our fourth session, I waded in. "Tell me about you and food, Brenda," I asked as kindly as I could. Her green eyes widened in alarm. Her sallow skin lost even more color, and she pulled back visibly. Then those eyes narrowed, and she smiled disarmingly. "What do you mean, me and food? That's a silly question." I told her what it was I saw in her appearance that had alerted me, and talked to her about the etiology of eating disorders, identifying it as a disease shared by many, many women. Helped Brenda put her own compulsive behavior in better perspective. It didn't take as long as I'd feared to get her talking. Brenda's story was long and complicated, and it took quite a while for her to sort out reality from her need to distort, cover up, and pretend. She'd gotten so proficient at dissembling that she'd become caught in her own web of lies. She had worked hard to perfect an image to present to the outside world, an image that would mask her fear, loneliness, and the terrible emptiness inside. It was very hard for her to assess her situation so that she could take steps to meet her own needs, and her neediness was why she stole compulsively, ate compulsively, vomited and ate again, and lied compulsively, desperately trying to cover her every move. Brenda's mother had also been a compulsive eater, grossly overweight as far back as Brenda could remember. Her father, a thin, wiry, energetic man, long since turned off by both his wife's appearance and her eccentric religiosity, had openly flouted his marriage vows for years. No one in the family doubted that he was unfaithful, and no one ever talked about it. Knowing it was one thing, but admitting it was another. A violation of the family's tacit agreement. What we don't acknowledge out loud doesn't exist for us as a family, and therefore can't hurt us. It was a rule Brenda rigorously applied to her own life. If she didn't admit that anything was wrong, then nothing was. Problems didn't exist unless she put them into words. No wonder she tenaciously clung to the very lies and fabrications that were destroying her. And no wonder being in therapy was so hard for her. Brenda grew up thin, wiry, like her dad, and immensely relieved that she could eat a lot, yet not get fat like her mother. At the age of 15, her body began to suddenly show the effects of the enormous amounts of food she ate. By the time she was 18, she weighed 240 pounds and was more desperately unhappy than she'd ever been. Daddy now said unkind things to this young woman, who had been his favorite child, about how she was turning out to be just like her mother after all. True, he wouldn't have said those things if he hadn't been drinking. But the fact was, he was drinking, most of the time now, even when he was home, which was seldom. Mom kept on praying and praising the Lord, and Dad kept on drinking and running around, and Brenda kept on eating, trying not to feel the panic rising within her. When she was away from home for the first time as a college student, and terribly lonely for the comfort of the same mother and father she also deplored, she made an incredible discovery. Alone in her room, in the middle of a binge, she realized that she could vomit up nearly everything she'd eaten and not be penalized for her enormous consumption of food by gaining weight. She was soon so entranced by the control she now felt over her weight that she began to fast and to vomit whatever she did eat. She was moving from the bulimic stage to the anorexic stage of her compulsive eating disorder. Brenda had repeated bouts of obesity interspersed with periods of extreme thinness over the next several years. What she never experienced during that time was a single day free from her obsession with food. She woke with hope each morning that today would be different from yesterday, and she went to bed each night with resolve to be normal tomorrow, often to wake in the middle of the night, primed for another binge. Brenda had no real understanding of what was happening to her. She did not know that she had an eating disorder, so often present in daughters of alcoholics, as well as in children of compulsive eaters. She didn't understand that she and her mother were both suffering from an allergy addiction to certain foods, principally refined carbohydrates, which almost exactly paralleled her father's allergy addiction to alcohol. None of them could safely ingest the smallest bit of their addictive substance without setting off an intense craving for more and more and more. And like her father's relationship to alcohol, Brenda's relationship to food, and especially to sugary baked goods, consisted of one long, drawn-out battle to control the substance that instead controlled her. She continued to practice self-induced vomiting for years after the time she first invented it in college. Her isolation and secretiveness became ever more involved and extreme, and in many ways this behavior was fostered by her family as well as by her disease. Brenda's family did not want to hear anything